Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
Welcome, everyone, to the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen. This is Matt Sorensen calling in live from the French Quarter in New Orleans. Mark Kohler,
Woo!
Where are you calling in from? Main Street, USA, the Granite State?
That's right, Main Street, USA. Definitely not the French Quarter of New Orleans. No action going on here.
It's okay.
Okay, there we go.
All right, well.
You know,
Today's open forum.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, well, we should give our disclaimer right off the bat because this is live. We do it through Blog Talk Radio, so those that would like to call in may do so. And we only do it once a month live, and so the quality for those used to these iTunes crisps recorded podcast, this is ghetto today. This is live. So how many times do you get real live radio nowadays? It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, this is coming out of the ghetto blaster today. And though we did get a lot of questions emailed in, I think, Mark, over 50. But if you do want to make sure your question gets answered, you can call in live. And you can be live on the show by dialing 646-668-8326. Once you get there, you got to press 1. That puts you in the queue, and our studio tech, Mark Joler, will come on and greet you and let us know. You got a live question.
Yeah, we're saying, yeah, it's old school here. But you know what? Hey, we love you guys, and thank you so much for your continued listening. We are skipping our weekly tax tip and legal tip. We want to jump right into your questions. A lot of people tell us this is their favorite show of the month because there's just a wide range of questions, and someone's like, oh, that's a great question. I've always wondered that, you know. And now that's assuming we answer it correctly, but it comes out. Nicely for everybody involved.
That's right. That's right. So, as you'll see, we do whiff on a few, but I always love open forum because we do get that variety of questions, and it's obviously fun for Mark and I to talk about these issues. So
yeah,
we got to get into this.
Well, I'll say this. Yeah, we got to dive in. I'll say this: if you haven't already emailed in your question, it's probably not going to happen today. If you do want to call in live again, we have a couple callers in the queue already. We'll reach out to you here shortly and make sure that you're heard on the air. And we'd love to field your question on tax or legal topics. So, Matt, why don't you give us the first?
Yeah.
We're going at this kind of reverse chronology, and those. So I'm doing the first come, first serve. Matt's doing the last in, first serve. So
yeah,
that way we're kind of getting a variety of.
I'm doing LIFO. Mark's doing FIFO.
LIFO.
Right.
Yeah, there we go. The accountants out there. Good call, Matt.
Out.
That was impressive. Yeah.
All right. Not even a CPA.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's.
You pulled that
one
out.
Question
okay.
Here. I got Chi from Dallas, Texas, wrote in with a great question. Says, I have an Oregon LLC that owned a few single-family rental properties in Oregon and an Indiana LLC that owned a few in Indiana. My goal is to sell them and use the proceeds to invest in apartments in Texas with a newly formed Texas LLC. My question is, when is a good time to terminate the Oregon LLC and Indiana LLC? Can a tenant still sue me after I sold my properties? What happens if the tenants sue and the LLC is already terminated? Do they get to go after the members of the LLC? Well, this is a great question. Now, there's 50 different answers to this question because we got 50 states, but the general rule is if the liability occurred when the entity was in good standing and was active, then the tenant is forced to sue the LLC. Even if you've dissolved the LLC, you've sold the property, they come sue you a year later, they're still forced to sue the LLC. You still get the protection of the LLC. Now, there are some differences of opinion. Some people will still say, particularly in states that aren't expensive, they'll say, I'm just going to keep the LLC open for a few years, let any statute of limitations pass on, you know, fraudulent non-disclosure or something when I sold the property. The developers will do this, for example. And that way, and then they'll dissolve them after that 3 years has passed. But I think for most people, if there wasn't issues on the property, you sold them, you're not having use for them, you can dissolve the entity. And as long as it was in good standing when the claim arose, when you own the property, you'll be able to have protection of the LLC, and they won't be able to sue you personally.
Good answer, Matt. And I'll just point out, if you are like, how do I do this process? I'm too busy. This is a pain in the rear. You can always have our paralegals wrap up that dissolution. I think we charge $150 for the legal work, mailing costs included. That's all included. And then there's usually a state filing fee. But if you want to get that done, mm-hmm. you can call Susan Kumpy at our office, Susan Kumpy, or email one of us and we'll hand it off to Susan. No lawyer time, no lawyer fees, just straight old paralegals knocking it out. I'm sorry, straight young paralegals knocking it out. the ladies do not like me to say old paralegals. Okay, well, we've got our first
experience.
Matt, we've got a live. Yeah, there we go. Experienced. Okay. Well, we got a live caller. Peter coming on the line. Let me bring him out. Peter, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Now, I think I've got to give a disclaimer here. Is I go, hey, Peter, I'm going to bring you out in the line. He's like, I think I got the feeling. I don't want to talk to you. Just read my question from my email. So, Peter, sorry. If, you know.
I'll
you
read
get
it.
Priority
it's fine.
Here, but you got to throw it out.
Okay, it's
thank
a long
you, man.
Question.
Hey, what do you
so
got for us?
I'll talk fast. So, can
okay.
I use it?
Okay.
So, I want to give you the question and then the context, and I'll talk very fast. Can I use a
okay.
trust account
try
to own real estate
yeah.
and achieve substantially similar asset protection from the trust as I would from an LLC? Alternatively, is there a less costly, less cumbersome way compared to LLCs to create asset protection on a property-by-property basis? Here's the context. I'm a house flipper in San Diego. I have owned and plan to own in the future rental property. Setting up a separate LLC for each property is very labor-intensive and very costly. I'd like to find another legal way to create asset protection from any present and future legal or governmental challenges regarding each separate property. I understand that first, setting up the LLC, and then second, closing the LLC after the sale of the property effectively freezes the future liability because there's no legal entity for the buyer or subsequent buyers or the government to pursue. However, as you know, this costs a lot
yeah.
of money and a lot of hassle. So it goes on.
Well,
do you want to listen to some more, or do you want me to stop?
No. This is good. Okay.
All
thanks,
right.
Peter. We'll let you go, and I appreciate you just throwing that out there. So stay on the line. And okay, so Matt, Peter brought up something that related to your last question on comment on
mm-hmm.
someone saying I'm going to dissolve LLCs right after the deal's over, which is a separate conversation.
Yeah.
Okay, so Peter, let me say this. Right when you asked your question, I knew you were from California. I just knew it because Californians hate, and I recently lived in California for 8 years, and as a self-respecting tax attorney, I had to move, and I hated this $800 minimum franchise tax for S-Corps and gross receipts tax for LLCs. It's a pain in the rear, and Peter, I feel your pain, but let me just say this first. Trusts do not give you asset protection. And this is for anyone in the country, a land trust, a revocable living trust, frankly, the type of trust you would want for simplicity and tax savings, gives you no asset protection. Now, I know there's people out there trying to sell land trusts going, oh, you're going to get asset protection, or do an irrevocable trust. They're not there a year later to help you do the tax return on an irrevocable trust. And did you get the word irrevocable in that sentence? That means you can't change it. And so you've got corporate.
And
I mean,
you've gone
got
to the highest
trust tax
rate possible. Yeah.
Yeah. It's
just increased
it's
your
just
tax
brutal.
Rate for that.
So follow-up was, well, if I can't use a trust to get asset protection, what do I do? Well, Peter, I would say this, and this is for anyone out there. And, Peter, you alluded to fix and flips. Let me say this, and I'll say this quickly because we have a lot of questions today. Remember, everybody, Matt Sorensen and I are believers in the two-sided equation, the yin and the yang. On the left side, you've got your operations. On the right side, you've got your holdings and rentals. So let's just talk rentals for a minute. If Peter's going to go out and buy rentals, maybe in California or in other states, Matt and I do not believe in setting up an LLC for every rental. Let's try to pool our rentals. Let's look at LLCs in other states, try to prevent the California minimum tax. There are some techniques to do that when you're doing business in other states, but we don't want to set up an LLC for every rental anyway. On the left side of the equation, doing flips and rehabs, Peter says, well, I want to set up an LLC for every flip, then close it down right after. Well, that might work in other states, but for California, it's just too costly. So what we normally do there, Peter, is I would make sure you're doing your flips in an S corporation, because you don't want to do flips in an LLC anyway, but I presume you had your LLC owned by your S corp. But the point is, I would use one S corp, do your flip, sell the property, move on. Do your flip, sell your property, and move on. And don't worry about an LLC for every project. And Matt, let me say one more thing, and then you debate with me on this. The last question was, hey, when I'm done with this property and it's gone and there was no lawsuits, can I just close my LLC? And Matt earlier said, sure, close your LLC if you're pretty sure there's no latent liability. But Peter, keep in mind, just because you close the LLC does not mean you close the door on liability forever. A plaintiff can say, hey, what happened to this LLC? And if there is some reasonable claims, they can go after the owners of the LLC individually if they prematurely close the LLC. Now, that's my take and my understanding, Matt. Do you disagree? What do you think about that? Just closing an LLC to think you wash your hands of a property. Oh, did I lose Matt? Matt, if you're on mute, I lost you.
I am here.
Let's debate this. I'm excited. Yeah.
I just had to have the speaker turn on my microphone. Thank you for recognizing me, Madam Speaker. Well, if it's the rental property scenario that we had earlier from Chi, I agree. The properties are all sold. You're not buying anything more in Oregon or Indiana. You're starting to buy in Texas. You want to just do a Texas LLC. Dissolve those LLCs. You didn't know anything was going on. There's nothing you were aware of. You sell the properties, then you dissolve the LLCs later. The law is going to say in all those states, this is kind of the general rule, I've researched this before, I think I even have a blog article from a few years ago on this, and from what that research said was, if the entity was active when the liability or the claim arose, you get the protection of the entity at that time, even if you've dissolved it after the fact. Now, if you switch around, though, and we go to Peter flipping houses, and especially if you're doing multiple deals, I want to keep entities active, leave it active, just keep using that same entity. But I don't think just because you shut down the entity, you're not going to get liability protection from claims that arose when the entity was active. But of course, you want to make sure you've ceased operations, you're not using that entity doesn't own anything, obviously before you shut it down, because you don't want to have claims arise later.
Yeah. And the moral of the story, and then we're going to move to our next question. Peter, in summary, have one primary entity you do all your flips in. You're going to want to do it as a corporation for tax purposes, and that includes the tax on an S corporation in the state of California for state tax purposes is better than an LLC, because an LLC is a gross receipts tax. So you're going to want to do an S corp anyway. And you may say, well, Mark, I want to isolate the liability to each flip. 90% of our clients don't do that. And once you close that property, the purpose of the S-Corp is to protect you. You're not going to maintain real estate in there anyway. So there's not going to be a pool of assets someone could go after. Anyway, we could beat this up further, but Peter, I hope those thoughts are helpful. And for anyone out there, don't feel like you have to set up an LLC for every flip you do. Have a primary parent company, typically an S-Corp for your flips. And that's plenty in a lot of ways. Make sure you have some good umbrella liability insurance sort of thing. Okay, well, I'm going to go chronologically here, and Matt, right. This is kind of up your alley. This is from Keith, and he wants to bring up the proposed tax plan by the GOP and Trump administration. Well, we'll at least take your question for 30 seconds here and basically say we don't know what it's going to look like, but here's the question from Keith. What are your views on the proposed tax plan? If I understand it correctly, they are talking about taxing S-Corps like C-Corps. There's a new flat tax at 20%, I think. Is this accurate, or is the new lower rate just for C-Corps? Thanks, Mark. Matt, what do you think? So go ahead, Matt. Do you want to field that for a second? Just kind of what's at least proposed.
Yes, yes. Yes. So I'm for it. You know, just want to let you guys know I'm campaigning. I'm for this tax reform for Trump. The good thing for business owners, S corporations, LLCs, what they've said is for pass-through business owners, we are going to have a maximum tax rate of actually 25%. Now, you may, a lot of people are like, well, crap, that sucks. I have an S corp or an LLC. I don't pay a corporate tax. That's why I set that up instead of a C corp. Yes, but now you don't have to pay tax at the individual level. See, they're taking away the pass-through and saying you don't pay at your individual level, which a lot of successful business owners are at a 35, 39% tax rate. I mean, they could be at a much, much higher rate. So instead, you're going to just pay at the entity, at the company level, and not have to pay again down at the individual level. So it's actually a good thing. It will overall, it should lessen the tax burden on business owners, small business owners. So so for that reason, I'm actually really excited about it.
Yeah, and I'll say this for Keith and for everybody. Again, we don't know what it's going to look like by the time it comes out of Congress. Of course, there's a lot of things that could happen. And we are all over this S-Corp LLC strategy. So as soon as something is passed, you're going to see an article, a radio show, and maybe even a webinar by us on the topic. Okay, Matt, do you want to throw out a question?
Yes. I've got a question here from Karen. She says, if I set up a solo 401k before December 31st for an S-Corp with the 1231 year end, when do I have to make the wage or employee contribution? Or sorry, she says, when I have to make the 25% of wages contribution? She's talking about employer contribution. Can I make it in 2018? Can I make that contribution even if the S-Corp has an operating loss? Ooh, good question, Karen. All right, now there's a few parts to this.
It was all good until that last part. It's nice and easy until that last loss question. You go first, Matt.
Let me hit this, and you can play cleanup as the CPA on the show. So first question and first part, this is really important. If you want to make 2017 401k contributions, you must have the solo 401k set up in 2017. So Karen's right on this first part here. She's trying to get it set up by December 31st. If you want to make 2017 contributions, you must have it set up in 2017. Now, don't call us on December 30th trying to get this set up, all right? Because of this, commercial interruption about to come here. We have a special on solo 401ks in November to try and help clients get them done in November. It's $200 off on S-Corps in November. We'll have more info coming out on that in the newsletter, and we're actually going to do a radio show, I believe, on solo 401ks in the next couple weeks. But critical part, must be set up in 2017. Now, the next part of this is, when do I make the contributions? So I set it up in 2017, but can I make contributions into 2018? Now, yes, you can do that. The contribution deadline is the tax return deadline for the company. So on your employer contribution, you actually have up to the tax return deadline, including extensions. So that's a significant amount of time to make the contributions. You can be making them in 2018. So yes, you can, if you don't have the money now in 2017, you can hold off and make those contributions into 2018. Now, I will say one caveat here. The employer contribution part, this 25% you brought up, is a little easier because that's just going to be an expense on your 1120S company tax return, an employee benefit expense for you, such a great employee. But your employee contribution in your solo K of your $18,000, or if you're over 50, you can do $24,000, that you'll need to be making and determining earlier because that contribution dollar amount goes on your W-2. Your W-2 is due by January 31st of 20. So you're going to need to, and you actually don't have to put that in until also the tax return deadline, but you do need to know what it's going to be so it's at least on your W-2. So there's a couple moving parts to that. Now, before we get to the loss part, Mark, any comments on those parts?
No. In fact, let's move it along, and I'll just say this. The loss is fine. I would make sure you meet with your accountant in December before you get too greedy on a 401k contribution when you have a loss. You want to look at the big picture and say, why are you making a 401k contribution and taking a W-2 if you're already at a loss? There's got to be kind of a bigger picture review of the situation, in my opinion, if I was your CPA. But you can technically have a loss in your corporation and do a W-2 and do a 401k. I just want to know where the money's mm-hmm. coming from if you got a loss. And let me say this in general for everybody. Woo! So if we didn't lose anybody, somebody may go, oh, my gosh, this open forum is so boring. Let me summarize some of these questions, and I know Matt does the same for me. For any of you that are a small business owner out there and you're having a great year and you want to put more money away for deferred tax savings, get a tax write-off, do some investing in a self-directed format, before year end, the 401k could be a perfect fit. And that's what Karen's talking about here. And so you want to be aware of this strategy in the next 6 weeks. Make sure that you get your 401k set up, determine how much you want to put in. Now, if you just only want to save $5,000, people, stick with an IRA or a Roth. But if you want to put away 10, 15, 20 grand or more, you're going to want to use the solo 401k strategy. Now, some of you that may have other employees, there's some considerations there. We can talk about it, but stay tuned for our radio show in the next 2 to 3 weeks regarding year-end 401ks. I think you'll love it. Now, for those out there that are still listening live on their computer or dialed in on their phone, if you have a live question.
It's not that bad.
No, we didn't lose anybody. If you have a question, you can call in at 646-668-8326. That's 646-668-8326, and press the number 1 so that we know you want to come out on the show. And then mute your computer if you're listening on your computer, and we'll talk to you on your phone. Okay, next question is from Angie. Now, this is kind of a unique one. Some of you might find this fascinating. Angie says, if your claim for a refund has expired due to statute of limitations 3 years have passed, when you file a late return, okay, let's stop there. Do you see what Angie's asking, everybody? There's someone out here that hasn't filed their taxes for 3 years or more, and they were due a refund 4 years ago and never filed a freaking tax return. And I know this isn't Angie because I know Angie. She's So Angie's friend, she's saying, well, is there any way to capture that refund? Because, folks, after 3 years, if you don't file a tax return and you were due a refund, the IRS says, too bad, we're going to keep your money. Now, they can audit you back up to 6 years, but you can only file your returns to get a refund up to 3 years ago. So if anybody's listening today and you're like, oh, I'm sure I was due a refund, I just never filed because I never got around to it. Well, look, get your butt in gear and get your return filed. Now, the strategy Angie is asking is, instead of claiming a refund and trying to get around this 3-year statute, what if I just check the box to apply any refunds to my next year's estimated payment? She said a CPA told her that that will help backdoor your refund onto your return. Angie, I've never heard of that, but if it works, go for it. I definitely would try it, check the box and see if it could happen, but I've never seen it. So, anyway, Matt, want me to throw out a question, or you got one? It's up to you.
Yeah, I got one here. This is actually for you.
Okay,
though.
You go for it. Okay.
This is a tax question. This is from Linda about JV agreements and tax docs. What type of tax forms are required to be issued when doing a joint venture? Are all joint ventures taxed as partnerships, or is there a way to avoid having to issue a K-1 and just do a 1099? As a specific example, a JV on a note investment. One person entity is the investor and finds and manages the deal. The other person entity funds the deal and may be consulted on decisions along the way on their desired level of involvement. All profits are split 50-50. Is this an implied partnership that would necessitate a K-1, meaning doing a partnership tax return? Does it make a difference if the lead entity is listed on assignment of deeds versus both parties are listed? All right.
Jeez,
so
anything
how
else? World peace? Gosh. All right.
Should go for that. Not against it.
Okay. All right.
Throw it in.
Okay. Here's the general rule, everybody. If you're going to do a joint venture, I mean, we're going to work together on a project. The general rule in the IRS's mind, and they've really upped their audit aggressiveness on this is that that is a partnership. You should file a 1065 partnership return, and everybody should get a K-1. The IRS wants to know what the heck's going on, who the partners are, and who's getting what. Now, that's the general rule. Now, to avoid any penalties or interest and just get the job done and probably fly under the radar, the next best idea, as the,
I'm listening.
As the listener asked, is do the deal in one listener's name, and then 1099 one partner's name. I was thinking of the listener of our show. Do the deal in one partner's name or their company name, and then in the joint venture agreement, agree to 1099 the other partner. Now I like what the listener said. Oh, but they're participating, involved in decision-making, because we don't want to use the I word called the investor word. That's a dirty word when it comes to, I'm going to just have borrow someone's money or take their money and do a deal and JV with them. And then you lose their money and you end up in a lawsuit or jail. So be careful making promises to, quote, investors. But if these are truly partners, they're involved, you're going to do the deal in your name or your company and then 1099 them, I can live with that, and that's what we do. That's kind of the down and dirty method. I would say a lot of people do that with JVs, and the IRS is not privy to it. They don't, you know, if they figured it out, they'd want a 1065 and might throw down some penalties, but I wouldn't worry too much about it. So there we go. Okay, so, I got a self-directed IRA question for you, Matt. Or is there a follow-up in that I missed?
No, I was just going to say, if you want to play it, you know, straight to the line, you know, straight and narrow path, just file the partnership return with that. If you want to get it done down and dirty, do the 1099 option.
Yep, there you go. Now, we've got another question here. This is from a client in Hawaii. We get the aloha right on the email right off the bat. This is from Brandy. And she's got a California question in the mix. And, Peter, you're going to like this. So it says, aloha, Mark. I'm looking into setting up a self-directed IRA. And in speaking with a facilitator, was given the option of setting up an IRA trust instead of an IRA LLC. Sound familiar, Peter? And this IRA trust instead of an IRA LLC will help me avoid the California franchise tax. Would this be a good option to work around the $800 fee, or are there downfalls? Matt?
Man. God, there's been a lot of bad stuff coming about because of this avoiding this $800. I feel like it's like people trying to get the magic diet pill rather than just eating healthy and working out. Yeah, like, oh, I don't want to do this.
Yeah,
I don't have to pay the price here.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple points I want to make there, and I'm going to go on a rant here. I'm just warning you. When I hear the word IRA facilitator, that's like someone who's wants to play lawyer or wants to be an IRA custodian but isn't. They're neither. Instead, they're just selling you some documents. They have no business advising you on them. They're like someone that just set up a little medical office and is like, I'm performing surgeries here. Are you a doctor? No. Are you a hospital? No. What are you? Well, I'm a medical facilitator. Okay. You don't want to be relying on these people's advice. I'm sorry. So
yeah, that's point number one. Be careful who you're taking advice from.
Now, the second point is exactly why you don't want to be talking to these people. They're going to recommend stuff that we don't think works. An IRA trust, and this has been sold in California pretty extensively, I think there's a big problem with it, and it's very different from an IRA LLC. So understand this first. An IRA is just a trust. And under the rules for IRAs, it says you're the owner, you know, you're the beneficiary of the trust, and you must have a trustee of your trust who is a custodian, who's a bank, a trust company, or a credit union. It can only be one of those three things. So that when I set up my IRA, I go get a custodian, right? And I have a trust because that's what an IRA is by law. Now, if I go then and set up another trust and have my IRA, which is already a trust, own another trust, and I say, well, I'll just be the trustee of this trust, that's not going to count. Because I think the tax court and the IRS is going to say, do you qualify as a trustee for IRA trust, especially when your IRA owns this new trust you just set up 100%. And I think that's going to be a problem. You're individually not going to qualify as a trustee of this. and that's going to disqualify that trust, and your IRA is going to be distributed. So now it's possible this theory might work, but if you're going to do this IRA trust, use a lawyer, get an opinion letter of some lawyer who's going to back it up. The reason there's a lot of facilitators out there selling it is because there's not many attorneys who are going to write that opinion letter to back that up.
Yep, and here's another issue too, and this goes back to Peter's issue that was our first caller today, is that guess what? As a trustee of a trust, you're very well personally liable for that trust activities. An LLC, under statute, the manager of an LLC is personally protected from the decisions you make. But
yeah,
when you are the trustee of a little trust and anything goes wrong in that trust, you're personally liable. So you're not getting asset protection. All you're trying to do is get a bank account set up for that IRA so you can do your deals and avoid the $800 fee. So be careful. We don't recommend it. And by the way, later in the email, I want to give Brandy some kudos here. She says, hey, I'd love to set up a time and talk. Let's do it right. And then she said, we're also planning to move to Arizona in a couple years, and we're just trying to do some note investing with our IRA. Well, frankly, if you live in California right now, which she points out, even though I got an aloha, she lives in California, you've got to register, you've got to set up this LLC in California. Once you move to Arizona, we can rip it out of California and you don't have to pay those fees anymore. Now, there's games you can play here. Maybe you set it up in Wyoming or Utah or Nevada and you use mail forwarding and your address isn't anywhere. You can play games to get around the $800 by still using an LLC, but if the state of California catches up to you, they're going to be a little perturbed and there's going to be a penalty for not paying your $800 every year. So anyway, you can go into it and be a little more aggressive, Brandy, but set up a call with us and we'd love to guide you through that. All right.
All right.
Matt,
well,
can we go to some healthcare or do you have something else? Oh, okay, go ahead.
Oh, great. You want to talk about healthcare? Oh, my gosh.
Oh, no.
Which, yeah, let's not even – there's all these new proposals coming out from Trump on healthcare, executive orders. Whew, it's getting hot and heavy. All right.
Yeah.
I got a question for you, Mark, and this one also comes with an aloha from Pono. So this is actually from Hawaii.
Okay.
So this is a Hawaiian aloha.
Okay, I can live with that. All right.
And he's got two tax questions. And these are good kind of foundational questions, I think, for people and get to some startup business expenses. The first question is, what's the difference between a tax deduction and a tax credit? Or is there even a difference? Example, the $5,000 tax deduction or credit as a new business startup? Got two questions, sir. I'm going to throw that one at you first.
Do you want to fill these one at a time? Well, let me say, yeah, guys, and what's the first name on that again? Kona?
Pono. Pono, P-O-N-O.
Okay, Kono. Okay, so... Well, Pono. Pono. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. So, Pono, here's the deal, and this is important for everybody listening. This $5,000 startup expense thing for people starting a small business, regrettably, Pono, that's not a deduction or a credit. That $5,000 is a limit of what you can expense in the first year. It's kind of a threshold. It says if you went and spent $3,225 buying two computers and a laptop and an iPad to start your business, you can deduct as an expense immediately up to $5,000. So that $3,225, you can write off immediately up to the $5,000. Anything, if you spend $7,000 and something dollars, you can deduct as an expense the first five, and then the other two, anything over $5,000, you have to amortize as a startup cost over time, kind of like depreciation. They're not a tax credit. No one's giving $5,000 to start a business as a tax bonus or tax credit when it comes to this startup expense. That $5,000 is a threshold or a limit of what you can actually expense, of what you actually spend. As an aside for everybody out there, there are cool tax credits where you can get a credit dollar for dollar against your income, but they're very few and far between, topic for another day. But this startup cost is not one of them. Part two, Matt, go ahead.
All right, I think part two is going to go a little better, Pono. Don't worry. Stick with us. I love part two. He says, I started paying my children from my business as outside services through my family management account. How can I start creating a retirement account for them where it's possible to have those accounts invest in real estate to build for their retirement or college fund?
Well, I'm going to pass this back to Matt quickly and say this. If you have a legitimate business and any of you out there are paying your kids under age 18 or over age 18, if they're under age 18 and you have an S-Corp, you're using this little family management company that Pono's talking about. But if any of you are paying your kids and you've got the financial wherewithal to set up a retirement account for them, they've got earned income now. Matt, what do you say? What are their options?
Roth IRA. Let's just start and end there. Do a Roth IRA first, because what tax bracket are they going to be in? Zero tax bracket, right? If you're paying them the $5,500 or so that they can put into the Roth, they're not going to have tax on it, and they're going to have a contribution into the Roth. Why else do I love the Roth? They can pull that money back out. If you want that $5,500 in 5 years when they're in college, or 3 years, whatever, you can pull that $5,500 back and use that money for college without a penalty, without any taxable issues. Roth IRAs, you can always pull out contributions back out. So it's actually a cool little savings account. Or, of course, just keep it invested and, you know, let them start having a Roth IRA to build for their retirement. Put it in on your real estate deals and add them in as a partner on an LLC for stuff you're doing. Love the ability to do that. Now, Mark,
now,
one thing that, just,
for,
that we've had questions on is do I need to do a W-2 or should they file a tax return if we're going to make that, let's say, Roth IRA contribution?
I was just going to say that. Great comment, Matt. If any of you listening today are going to pay your kids before year end and then just take a write-off for helping them in the, you know, having them help in the business and then turning around and using their money for school clothes or school lunch or soccer, that's great. Make sure they have a legitimate role in the business. We've talked about this ad nauseum here on the show. But if some of you are going to try to make an IRA contribution later in the spring, most of your accountants and even some of the IRA companies where you set up this Roth, they're going to have a little heartburn when this kid doesn't have a W-2. Now, even though the W-2 doesn't, you don't pay any tax on that. There's no withholdings if they're under age 18. It's all zeros, except for their gross pay. It's still important to file the W-2 because it kind of just checks the box in the eyes of the IRS that this kid actually had earned income. So when Miley Cyrus was making the big money under age 18, she was probably funding 401ks and IRAs, but she was also claiming income. Being a teenage diva. So it's the same story for all of you out there with kids too. You got to claim the income if you're going to do it. So
that was probably the last person I would think is making retirement plan contributions. Could you come up with someone else in your example besides Miley Cyrus?
Hey, come on. I'm sure Miley Cyrus, you know, this will blow some of your guys' mind. She was making, when she was 17 years old, I heard it was from 17, 18. She was making $1 million a day from just music and products through the Disney machine. Million a day.
Wow.
By the time she was 18, for over 3 years, she had made $1 billion, people. Gross. Now, that's gross. That's $1 million a day in gross revenue under her brand, Miley Cyrus, as a 15, 16-year-old. Are you kidding me?
Huh.
So I'm sure she had some good tax advisors who were like, well, why don't we throw a little bit at a 401k for her? I would hope, but who knows. Okay.
I got another question. I got you.
All right. Okay. This is for Dave. This is from Dave. He says, love the show. Thanks for all you do. I have an expanded note investing business recently to include flipping properties. Okay, now back to what Matt and I said at the beginning of the show, yin and yang, left side, right side. So he's got note investing and flipping in properties. Those to me are left side, right side, flipping on the left, note investing on the right. But he says, I have an LLC that I considered a management company for my various business lines as my business expands. I also have another LLC that's working holding company notes and investments. I listened to your recent podcast on S-Corps. I think I'm due to discuss this with my CPA. What are a few questions I should know the answer to before going into the conversation to help the attorney CPA determine whether converting the holding LLC to an S-Corp and further to determine the timing? Now, Dave, let me say this right off the bat, if I may. Matt, then you back clean up on this one. The main thing here, Dave, is you would generally never convert an LLC for notes and investing to an S-corp. Leave it alone. Let it be an LLC. Let it do its notes, points, interest, first trust deeds, second trust deeds, hard money, whatever. It's a holding company investment LLC. It would never become an S-corp. But your other LLC that is your management company, of which you're doing flipping of properties, that's the one you'll consider to convert to an S-corp. And everybody listening, you've maybe heard it before, and I'll say it again, I want to know immediately how much money you expect to make this year or expect in 2018. And that's the number I'm going to want to know, Dave. What is your expected gross and net income on the flipping, not on the investing and holding? That's not an S-corp. That's just a holding LLC. So that's what I would want to know, Dave. Have your numbers ready to go, and then have the conversation. Matt, anything?
Love it. Love it. And on that operational flipping side, just keep in mind, you know, once you're about $30,000 to $40,000 of net income is when it makes sense from a tax saving standpoint to have the S corporation over on that operation side. But gosh, Mark's so smart. This is just so well said.
Oh, all right. You're so nice. Thank you, Matt. All right. Do you have an IRA question?
Oh, good.
Those are the ones that
I do, actually.
Yeah, go ahead. What do you got?
I do.
Okay.
I do. So this is from Chetan, who wrote in and says, Mark and Matt, recently started listening to this show. I really like the idea of self-directing my IRA, .. My question for you is probably both a tax and legal question with regards to using the self-directed IRA LLC solely for lending. God, we got a lot of people doing private lending right now. If I use it for private lending, which lending laws apply? The laws of the state where the IRA LLC is established or where the company receiving the loan is established if two different states are involved? All right, this is a good question. Now, this is going to be this answer of what lending laws apply applies for any type of lending, you know, not just the IRA LLC. This is just for anybody doing private lending. And I want to make a couple comments on that first. There are some federal laws regarding private lending you want to become familiar with, particularly if you're loaning to individuals. If you're loaning on investment deals to companies, there are a lot of exemptions to some of these federal lending laws. But when it comes to state lending laws, for example, usury laws, most states have a usury law that says this is the maximum legal rate of interest you can charge. Some of them also have licensing requirements in certain states. But generally what you're going to first look at is where is the loan occurring in terms of the property. So if you're lending on real estate, and let's say it's a property in Indiana, but you live in Illinois, we're going to be looking at the lending laws of Indiana because you're going to want to draft those documents to conform to Indiana law. So the lending laws of Indiana are going to apply. If it's not secured by real estate, the loan, which is a little more risky, and we, you know, there's a lot of caveats to whether you should or shouldn't do that. But if you're lending unsecured, then we're probably going to be looking at the state of where the borrower is located and making sure you're complying with those laws of where the borrower is located. So now in each set of documents on your note and your mortgage or deed of trust, there's a section that says what state laws apply. Even if you try and pick another state, let's say you try and pick a state that has very lax lending laws, but you're lending in a state on a property in a state, you're going to still have to be subjected to that state's law where the loan is going into.
I love it, Matt. And Matt referenced the laws for your documentation. Let me just address the LLC issue. Typically, we're going to set up the LLC where you live. So where you, the lender, lives, we're going to set up your LLC there. That's where you hold your investments. That's where your IRA could be. You know, that's you. But you're going to want to comply with the laws in these other states as you lend to other people or on property in other states. But the LLC doesn't have to be registered in Indiana in that example. I would set up the LLC where you live. Matt, is that acceptable with you?
Yep. I concur.
Okay. Okay. All right. We're going to go to a healthcare question. This is from Andrew. Woo! Now, he said, during your healthcare strategies podcast show not long ago, you mentioned how you can use an HRA, or health reimbursement arrangement, to cover costs above and beyond your health savings account if you're spending too quickly and can't keep up. Can you elaborate on the advantage of this? is there any different than paying for health costs personally? And then when the new year rolls around, putting more cash into an HSA and reimbursing yourself, I feel like I must be missing a key point here. Well, first, let's elaborate on the advantage of an HRA. The HRA is a reimbursement arrangement. It's not a use it, you lose it plan. It's not like a savings account like an HSA. It's not like an IRA like an HSA. It's just a reimbursement arrangement. And if you're married, they're a lot cheaper and easier to implement because we hire your spouse and provide health care for the spouse, which includes all of his or her dependents, which includes you. And it's a great and an easy way to just cover extra medical expenses. Now, for any of you out there that just have $2,000 to $5,000 in medical each year, you want to get a write-off for it, never pay for it personally. You want to have an HSA in the mix. Now, it is true, as Andrew said, the HSA can reimburse you for paying for it personally, but there's no tax benefit on the face of it for just paying for medical expenses out of your pocket. You either want to use an HRA, which you can deduct up to $10,000 of medical expenses, or you can use the HSA and get a contribution deduction of about $3,300, $3,400 if you're single, $6,500-ish if you're married or head of household. So anyway, there's kind of a combination effect. You can use both. That's, Andrew, what I was saying in our show a few weeks ago, is if you're tapping out your HSA and you've got 10 or 15 grand in medical, you might want to throw an HRA on top of it. Now, with all that said, for many of you, that could sound like a lot of garbly goop. I'm holding my annual year-end healthcare webinar where I share my computer screen and webcam. It's next week. It's $20, cheap and affordable. You can watch and listen in. It's recorded. I would love to have any of you interested in the healthcare planning strategy to tune in for that. You can sign up through the link on our newsletter. And keep in mind Obamacare, because it's here to stay for now, the enrollment period starts November 1st, just 2 weeks from now. And the Trump administration has shortened the window. It's only from November 1st to December 15th. So everybody has 6 weeks to get their act together for health care if you're going to go through one of the exchanges. So I'm going to cover this and more in the webinar next week. So Andrew, I would tune in for that, and you'll be able to even get more info on how this could work. Matt, the floor is yours.
All right.
Do you have a question?
All right. Back to you, Matt, in the studio. All right. Well, I've got a question from Matt Bennett on self-directed IRAs. Sorry, I don't know if my jokes are hitting today. I don't know. Maybe it's in the French Quarter. I don't know. I don't have like the laugh reel coming on. Yeah, I don't have like the laugh reel coming on. It's a little chuckles from the audience. I just don't know.
Yeah.
All right.
We should have that.
Okay, well. We do, huh? It just makes me feel a little better. All right.
Yeah.
Okay, this question from Matt wrote in regarding moving retirement accounts around. And this is a great question because it gets to a couple of issues. The first question he says is, I'm with Vanguard and have about $400,000 in an employee plan. $125,000 of that is Roth. My wife is with Vanguard as well, with $225,000 in a solo K, $75,000 of that is in Roth. My employer uses Vanguard as custodian. Am I able to move any of that money from Vanguard to another custodian? All right, now this is an important issue for anyone who wants to self-direct their retirement account or really just kind of move your money from an employer custodian or from your employer retirement account. If you work for a company and you're still employed there, generally speaking, you are locked down and you cannot move the money. Almost every company restricts you from moving money out of the plan while you're still employed there. The only exception is if you've reached retirement plan age under the plan. Retirement plan age is usually going to be 55 or 59 and a half under 401k or 403b plans. Once you reach retirement plan age, you can roll out your funds to a self-directed IRA or to whatever custodian you want. So, Matt, if you're still employed by this employer and you're not at retirement plan age, I'm sorry, but your money is locked down until you leave that employer or until you reach the retirement plan age under the plan. All right. Now, the good news is your wife, who is self-employed she is going to be able to move her money wherever she wants. She already has a solo 401k at Vanguard. She's going to be able to move the money to a solo 401k plan that lets her self-direct if she wants. We offer those within our firm. You don't need a custodian on a solo 401k to self-direct. She can keep the Roth funds and the non-Roth funds together and can self-direct both of them if she wants. So for her, obviously she can move the money, but sorry, I think your funds are going to be locked down, again, unless you're over the retirement plan age.
Wow, great comments, Matt. And you know what? I'm just sitting here having such a good time. I really do. I love open forum, and I appreciate all of you that I know many of you have said, Mark, if there's a question I don't like, I zone out, and then I wait for you guys to pose the next question, and maybe I zone in. So I want to tell all of you, thank you so much for listening in. I want to let you know, when Matt starts talking, I usually zone out too. So I know what you're going through. Sorry. Okay, I'm trying to get my humor
so
in today.
My wife
all right.
And my kids. I know. I'm used to it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, this question is from a fellow accounting professional in Northeast Pennsylvania, Brian Graves of Graves Accounting and Consulting, giving him a little shout out. He said,
I think
Mark,
this is going to be a complicated. Is this going to be a hard question?
No, this is, you can tune in. Do not zone out, Matt.
Okay.
This is going to be good.
Okay.
So everybody's going to love this. So this is a fellow accounting professional doing bookkeeping and payroll for clients all over Northeast Pennsylvania. He says, a CPA recently told my client, who is a single member LLC, this is for everybody out there, single member LLC doing operations. He said a CPA recently told my client in this situation that it was not worth making the S-Corp election. My figures show a significant savings in self-employment tax. He says, tell me if I'm not crazy. My client had a net income of $116,000. If he paid himself a salary of 30%, taking of this figure, the balance $81,000 in distributions, I show he would save close to $12,470 in self-employment tax. Earnings paid a salary would be $34,000, blah, blah, blah. And he goes on, then we get a little more. But he goes, could you address this? And basically, Brian, I'm going to read into your statement. He's saying, am I nuts? Is this CPA crazy? And Brian, you are as sane as they come. You are on it. You know exactly what the issue is. You are correct. I would completely concur with what you're doing. The CPA that was misleading your client was doing just that, giving bad advice. And so I would definitely encourage this client to do a retroactive election as an S-Corp for the year of 2017, get them on payroll for third and fourth quarter, and freaking run with it. And if the CPA needs to get a tongue lashing, give them a copy of my book, The Tax and Legal Playbook, and have them read the chapter on S-Corps and look at my payroll matrix. I put my money where my mouth is. And I think for anybody listening here, again, if you have operational income, selling a product, a service, flipping property, whatever, and you're making over 100 grand like this example, oh my gosh, you got to be looking at the S-Corp. You're leaving thousands on the table. So, Brian, great question. Bam. Boom.
Wow.
There you go.
I love that. You got a little, you know, you got into that one. I like it.
You want a little softball, Matt? I got a little softball for you. Here's a softball.
Okay.
This is from Eugene.
Yes.
Eugene says, EIN for my sole proprietorship. Do I have to get an EIN for my sole prop? For anybody out there listening, do you need an EIN for your sole prop? Matt, what would you say?
You can use your Social Security number. You don't need an EIN, but just because you have one, it's not a problem. In fact, there are some scenarios where we're going to get an EIN for your sole prop. For example, if you're setting up a solo 401k, you actually must get an EIN for the business instead of your social to adopt the solo 401k. And there may be other instances where you'd need that if you're doing some payroll, you got some employees, or. But no, I would not stress out about having an EIN for your sole prop.
Okay, and I got another question for you, Matt, and this is a good one. I think our listeners are going to freak out on this one. This was good. Cryptocurrency.
Oh, yeah.
This is a big topic, people, for anybody out there trading Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies. So here's the question. I'm going to throw it at Matt. He says, okay, anyway, he gives us a little background, and he's used a self-directed checkbook IRA, and he says, here's my question. I was planning to do cryptocurrency trading inside my checkbook IRA LLC, and assuming as the manager of my IRA LLC, I would be free to trade with my account, not only holding for long-term, but trading actively. I figured as long as no IRA prohibited transactions rules were broken, I could do this. So the question is, Matt, can people take their IRA, form an LLC, be the manager of that LLC, and invest in Bitcoin with their IRA?
Absolutely, yes. I've got a video on this, actually, and a blog article. Yeah, baby. Go to SDRAhandbook.com. Of course, you can find it there. But now, here's a couple just practical points when you do that. When you're buying Bitcoin, there's a number of different ways you store, or whatever the cryptocurrency is, but there's a number of different ways to store cryptocurrency and essentially to buy and sell it. The first thing to know is you must have what's called a wallet. For example, Coinbase is the big player in this space. Coinbase is a company that you basically set up a wallet. And what it allows you to do is you link a bank account. So in this instance, you link your IRA LLC bank checking account to the Coinbase wallet. And that checking account allows you to trade dollars for cryptocurrency, such as Bitcoin. And then you can sell it back and forth. So it does require a bank account. You can't just do it directly out of your IRA because you need a bank account linked. That's why the LLC is a great solution for this, because you can link your LLC checking account to the Coinbase wallet, and now you can practically buy and sell back Bitcoin or whatever cryptocurrency you're into.
Oh, Matt, awesome question. I learned something there. Cryptocurrency blows my mind, so I'm grateful you were able to answer that. Okay, I've got several
questions here. And here, let me say this, too.
I was going to
give a little thing on this, too. I had a client buy Bitcoin, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, like really when it was pretty new, at like 20 cents a Bitcoin. And it's like over $4,000 per Bitcoin now. He bought it back at 20 cents. I don't think he bought that much. It's got $1 million plus now in Bitcoin. It's crazy. And I remember when he bought that and he asked me about it. And he actually bought it in his solo 401k. I was like, I should just buy some. I should just buy like $500 of it just to see how it works so I can answer some of these people's questions. And I just didn't do it. And of course, now I'm kicking myself, like, as we do.
Wow.
So.
Well. That's hard. Well, okay, I've got a couple travel questions in our last 2 minutes. I'm going to move quickly, and this is a question from Love Betty. I also have Eric. Eric says, Mark, is it true that I could visit your Hawaii workshop next month and take a tax write-off? And how would that work? And he kind of goes on to elaborate travel expenses. Let me say this in general. Anybody, when you travel to a workshop, travel to check on your rental property, travel to go meet a customer or a vendor, have your annual meeting with your board of directors, as long as it's legit, you are able to write off 100% of your airfare there and back, at least a couple nights of hotel, and your food 50% while you're there. And so we're putting together a little – so everybody, that's any travel during the holidays. I love this topic. And, in fact, if any of you are interested in coming to Hawaii, we're going to have a little link on our newsletter next week with some deals. I wanted to go on here. I wish Love Betty I could answer this. What a great handle for our email. But anyway, I'll send you an email on that. And many of you, if we weren't able to get to your questions today, we will try to send you a quick email with an answer or a blog article linking it. We want to say thank you so much for listening and being a part of our show today. I'm so sorry if we didn't get to some of your questions via email. Matt, what would you like to say? Any final words here?
Hey, always great to be with you guys. Thanks so much for sending in your questions. Of course, I just want to give a little plug. If you love the show, go give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Send her Mark or I an email. Let us know you did, and we'll be happy to send you a free copy of one of our books you just pick. Let us know you did the review, and we'd be happy to say thanks with a free copy of our book.
Yep. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next week. We need to do more open forum shows, Matt. got to get on that.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.